This Slate spoiler special is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 700,000 high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use the offer code SPOILER7.
Hi, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, here with the Slate spoiler special podcast on Pacific Rim, the new Guillermo del Toro monster robot battling movie.
Yeah.
Joining me in the studio is Forrest Wickman, a Slate contributor. Hey, Slate. Hey, Slate.
Hey.
Hey, Slate, representative
hey,
of Slate.
Co-Slate. Hey, Dana.
Signifier of an entire magazine. So we saw 5 minutes of this movie together last night because I had missed the beginning of the previous screening. So I just sat through the very beginning with you and then dashed out. So I have no idea how you took it overall. Good, bad?
I loved it. I will probably go see it again. I thought it was probably the best blockbuster I've seen since like Inception or Avatar, you know, largely because we've talked about a bunch of different blockbusters, and it's always like Iron Man 3, The Avengers, Star Trek, you know, it's a lot of sequels. And
right. Yeah, and this is the only original idea so far this summer, right? I mean, of the big tentpoles, has there been another that's
I'm
not based on anything?
I'm pretty sure that's right. I mean, the last one I can even think of is Super 8. But that is another sort of – even Super 8 is like – it's sort of like this in that it's a sort of homage to other monster movies that the director loved growing up. So there's a limit to this movie's originality, but it really makes it fresh, which I loved it for. You know, as a Del Toro – if you're coming to this not as a blockbuster fan but as a Del Toro fan, it's not Pan's Labyrinth. I think his non-Hollywood movies are generally – better than his Hollywood movies, but I would still say it's among his best and probably the best of his Hollywood movies.
But if you're coming as a Hellboy fan, his two Hellboy movies, right? I mean,
absolutely.
I feel like it's in that vein, except at a larger scale.
Right.
And in fact, scale is probably the first thing we should talk about when talking about Pacific Rim. It's already evident in the posters and the trailers that, you know, we've got a lot of big robots and big monsters and big superheroes out there every summer, but these guys are big, right? I mean, the scale is basically 25-story buildings,
right?
So it is in the category of, you know, Godzilla or one of the great Japanese monster movies in terms of how much they tower over the cities they destroy.
Yeah, absolutely. And the movie has a lot of fun with that. It could totally get wasted if they just, like, stayed on the perspective of the monsters and the robots. But they do some fun jumping back and forth between, like, the sort of ant's eye view and the monster's eye view that is really fun. So you get, you know, 1 second, a giant Jaeger, that's the name of the robots, you know, hitting a monster with an aircraft carrier, and then, I don't know if this is the same shot, but, like, the monster hits a building, and in the building, like, one of those marble swinger things.
Right,
Zen toys
that people have on their desk.
Yeah, it just, like, triggers that.
And yeah,
that's
a fun little
funny jokes.
Scale
like
jokes like that,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Well, okay, let's set up the world that this movie takes place in, which is pretty complicated. I mean, there's a lot of fantasy world building. I sort of actually wish there was more, because that was really my favorite part of the movie, was just Del Toro's imagination about, you know, the future and how this whole giant robot monster battle would work. So we don't know quite how far in the future we are, right? But it's not far. It's
we're
a decade or so.
We're in the 2020s, I think. I did a little math, and we're like somewhere around 2022.
Right. And so the apocalyptic event that has happened, which is sort of two bizarre great things at once, is that creatures have come not from outer space but from within the Earth.
Right. Under the ocean.
Under the ocean, but also through a portal from another dimension.
That has been there for a very long time, since the dinosaurs, we later learned.
The dinosaurs were the first
emissaries. That was a very silly part of this movie,
but I love the idea that the scientists, one of the, you know, great faux science expository moments is explaining that the dinosaurs, were precursors, kind of testing the ground for this future race of monsters.
Yeah.
So they've come through a portal from another dimension, through the Breach, which is this big hole in the Earth under the Pacific Ocean. And essentially for the last decade or so, they've been terrorizing all the cities around the Pacific Rim, which also made me laugh because it made me imagine people on the Atlantic coast just kind of kicking back watching the whole thing. So instead of seeing New York get destroyed, which it seems like we see in every superhero movie, we most of the time are in Hong Kong in this movie or Alaska.
In the sort of exposition at the beginning, it starts with the first monster shows up at the Golden Gate Bridge. It goes straight for a landmark, of course. But most of the movie takes place in Hong Kong.
And so in this future, it's actually we're sort of in the second stage of the battle against the monsters, right? The idea of the first stage is that mankind, as a unit, right, as an international unit, because the UN seems to be in control of things, which is another bizarre thing about this movie's future, right? It's like it's all international. That these huge robots called Jaegers, around the size of the monsters, have been constructed, operated by a person inside to fight the monsters.
Right.
But it's soon discovered that controlling these huge robots as a kind of a proxy inside, basically you are hooked up to, you know, a bunch of sensors and you move in certain ways and the giant robot around you moves in the same ways. But it's too much for one person. The neural load will be fatal.
Yeah.
And so they have to be controlled by two people, one for each hemisphere of the robot, I think?
That's how it's explained, although the exact mechanics of it are a little vague because it's not as if you have, you know, while one person ostensibly represents the left hemisphere, it doesn't seem like they only control the right arm and the right leg.
It's probably like the brain in that way, right? The idea is that, like, the two people together piloting the robot, the co-pilot, the pilot pair constitute a single brain. And that gives rise to, I think, the nicest conceptual thing in the movie that I also wish had been explored more, which is the neural drift.
Yeah.
And this idea that your brain has to be in perfect sync with the co-pilot. That's the most difficult part of piloting it, which is why a lot of the most famous pilot pairs that we meet are related to each other. There's a father-son. There's two brothers. One of them becomes the main character of the movie.
There's two Russians that share haircuts.
Yeah, there's two really, really
that's
great,
the only explanation
scary,
we get
bleach
for them,
blonde
I
Russians.
Think.
I think they're supposed to be siblings because they have the same last name. Maybe their husband
and
wife. And
then there's the triplets.
And then there's, it's a Chinese triplets who have a three-armed robot that they control. So that's all established very quickly.
Or it has two arms, I think. It has two sets of arms.
Right.
Rather than three sets of arms. Because two people equals one set of arms. And so I guess the idea is that three people, therefore, can only add one extra set of arms. It's not as F.
You've thought
otherwise,
this way
the neural load would clearly
be
too much.
So in the pre-credit sequence, we meet our hero, sort of our nominal hero, though he's actually kind of a cipher and one of the least interesting characters in the movie.
Yeah.
His name is Raleigh Beckett.
Raleigh.
And he's played by Charlie Hunnam from TV's Sons of Anarchy. He was not a familiar actor to me.
Yeah.
And he's one half of this famous brother team, right? So in the very beginning, we see him and his macho brother operating a Jaeger in kind of the early glory days of the Jaeger Wars.
Right.
Then they make a bad decision and disobey the orders of their superior, played by Idris Elba, in battle. And as a result, his brother dies.
Yeah.
Right? And so this is the trauma that begins the movie and strands him on the beach in this kind of great, the poster scene, right, of this huge robot kneeling on a beach with this tiny little man.
Yeah, a beach in Alaska, I guess. He sort of drags himself single-handedly all the way there and has PTSD, so he goes to work as a construction worker.
On the wall of life.
Right. Is that what it's called?
The wall of life
is
the new strategy for fighting the Jaeger. So the idea is we're just going to build this giant wall they won't be able to get past. Of course, they immediately, you know, it's like an Oreo cookie to them. They tear their way right through it. But so at the beginning, he's sort of in exile, not unlike Superman at the beginning of the Man of Steel movie this summer, right? He's been traumatized, and so he's off doing some manly construction work to kind of, you know, rebuild his soul. Meanwhile, back in Hong Kong, right? The Jaeger program, I believe, has been decommissioned or the UN is trying to phase it out.
Right. So basically what has happened is that the monsters have, you know, for a while they began winning the war against the Kaiju, which is what the monsters are called. But then the monsters just keep getting bigger and coming out more often. So they start losing. And that's when they are like, okay, this isn't working. We need to try the wall. And they phase out. They begin to phase out the Jaeger program. But I guess Idris Elba's character, whose name is Stryker or something?
No, he has
what
the best
it?
Name.
Stacker.
Stacker Pentecost.
Stacker Pentecost. He just, you know, takes the whole program and whisks it off to Hong Kong to set up
and there. Essentially kind of turns it into a resistance movement, right? He's sort of like, we're going to keep on doing it as a bunch of ragtag rebellion, you know, whatever. We're gonna mount the last stand of the Jaegers, whether the UN wants us to or not.
Right.
So let's go through that team because there's all these characters I think are kind of great. What I like about this movie is that all the small characters are pretty interesting. Actually, most of these characters aren't even that small. We're about to mention they're pretty major. So the woman who eventually becomes the co-pilot of Charlie Hunnam's character,
played
by Rinko Kikuchi, who I remember from Babel. I love that actress.
Yeah,
she's great.
Yeah.
I'm really happy to see her back again.
She's also in The Brothers Bloom, which she has, I don't know. I remember liking her in that as well.
Oh, I couldn't stand that movie, but I like her and everything. So she is a Japanese woman who's lost her entire family to the kaiju when she was a kid. We see this in a flashback during a neural drift session where she's bonding brains with her co-pilot.
Yeah, that's something we should make. So in addition to needing, you know, how each pilot has to sort of mind meld with their co-pilot and have an intimate bond with them, they also can be haunted by their past and, like, have all these memories come back and then sort of go down the rabbit hole as it's described.
Don't go down the rabbit hole.
Don't chase the
rabbit.
She's chasing the rabbit. Yeah. There's a lot of, so in this movie, there's a lot of really silly mythology that's explained in I think, like, a pretty elegant fun
oh, but
way.
Can I just say, like, I love the rabbit it. My, and the my neural, favorite the thing handshake. Is the trippy sequences of people going into
I mean,
neural
silly
drift.
In a good way. I mean, I'm not bashing it for that.
No,
silly
I actually, I love those scenes. They remind me of the end of 2001, you know, the sort of trippy psychedelic sequence. The idea that kind of going inside your brain is just as exciting an adventure as fighting a monster.
Beyond
I wish
the
there
infinite.
Had been more of that. So she becomes his partner, and sort of, there's sort of a romantic thing between them, although that's not a major part of the movie.
Yeah, drifting for them seems to be almost sexual.
Yeah, go with the drift.
It's don't like in Avatar it. Where they plug in their tails together or something. There's a similar thing going on here.
So that's one pair. We've talked about the other pilot pairs. Oh, then the scientists are also very important characters in this movie because, as you can tell from our attempted a plot description, there's all kinds of crazy science to be explored.
Yeah.
And I like the science characters, although the Charlie Day character had this voice that just grated on my nerves.
Grating, yeah. It's a little obnoxious.
I think it's meant to be. I mean, the broad comic relief even is kind of part of this movie's, I think, bow to old monster movies.
Right? And I think also he's maybe supposed to be a character for kids. He was like almost the Jar Jar Binks of this movie for me. But I think a lot of kids will probably like him. He's the character that if you love monsters that you get to sympathize with because he not only respects their power, he clearly like so monsters and Jaegers have become action figures and stuff. And he has that same sort of a part of him just knows this is cool.
That's true. And even though I found that performance a little bit too high strung and grating, I do love his character's curiosity, you know, and there's an excuse for all the science explanation because he's just so passionate about the monsters and all the monster parts. And I guess no monster has ever been captured alive. Obviously, they're killed, but their organs are kept alive in vats, basically, to be tested. And so he's obsessed with finding a kaiju brain that he can study. And he at one point attempts neural drift with a kaiju brain. Another of my
Which
favorite
was
scenes.
Nuts, yeah.
And then there's another science character played by Bern Gorman, who's more like the math nerd. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of mention something else I love about the science scenes, and I think this is also just Guillermo del Toro's weird passion, is that there's this kind of steampunk element to the design that you'll see here and there. And there's this moment in the lab, you know, that's full of all these cool vats full of monster brains and monster parts, where I think it is the scene where he's neurally drifting, and in the background you see this bellows, like an old-fashioned wooden bellows kind of like taped to something, and there's just kind of a sense that, you know, they're throwing it together from old parts that could be, you know, back from the 19th century or something. It was kind of great.
Yeah, Ron Perlman's costuming reminded me a little bit of that, too, where he has, like, I don't know, these very odd sort of steampunky sunglasses and these gold shoes. So he's another character. He's eventually, the scientist played by Charlie Day needs to get another brain to drift with a kaiju again. And so he discovers that there's this black market for kaiju parts. And so that's how he meets the Ron Perlman character, whose name is Hannibal Chow or something.
After his favorite character in history and his second favorite Chinese restaurant in Brooklyn. We should mention, too, that Ron Perlman is completely a muse for Guillermo del Toro. I think he's been in every single one of his movies. And, of course, he was Hellboy
going
in the
back
Hellboy
to Kronos,
movies.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they're old buddies. And I wish there was more Ron Perlman. You can never get enough Ron Perlman. Since
Did
we're
you stay around after the
Yes.
The
There's an Easter egg with Ron Perlman. People should know. They should stick around for at least part of the very long credit sequence to see that. What about Ron Perlman's fate?
And
I was sort of sad.
Should we spoil what it is? I mean, it's not...
What,
if you
eggs?
Missed it and you thought Ron Perlman died, he, you know, uses his special butterfly knife thing or switchblade. I don't know exactly what it is to carve his way out of the
monster that we thought had eaten him. Right. Is there anything else we want to say about character design, about the way the monsters look? I mean, just tell me the things that kind of left you buzzing from this movie.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. So, well, we should definitely talk about the design of the monsters, because that's, I mean, famously, that's one of, there was a whole New Yorker profile that was very long just about how much Del Toro loves creatures and creature design, and the creature design in this movie is great. I mean, that's consistently a difficult issue, that the creatures, when you finally show them, can be disappointing. That's why Super 8 held it F for so long. There's the whole Jaws idea of just don't show the monster. But Del Toro just loves to design monsters so elaborate.
Do you remember that plant monster in one of the Hellboy movies?
Yeah, and
so
Hellboy
great.
2. I think it's Hellboy 2. It's really great. And yeah, in this movie, so he gets to show the monsters for a long time, and you get to – I loved how there just kept being new dimensions of the monster where, like, their face would open up and there would be another face inside it, and sort of alien style. Or at first you might think, oh, this sort of looks like a hammerhead shark, but then it would turn around and its tail is more like an ankylosaurus or
right.
something.
Or the moment when one can fly out of the blue.
Yeah.
You had no idea it could fly.
It
also, all of them seem to share in common that they have this blue fluorescent kind of blood,
right.
which looked really, really great on the screen. But what did you think of the 3D in general? I thought it was pretty unnecessary and a little bit heavy-inducing.
I like 3D when it comes to these movies that are creating a different world for you to get immersed in. And I thought I really liked it. I'm glad I saw it in 3D, and I would recommend it if you liked seeing Avatar in 3D. This isn't quite on that level.
I think I saw a bad
idea.
Projection. There was just bad projection in my screening or something. But yeah, I could tell it was trying to do
Avatar-esque
things.
Were you off to the side or?
I didn't have a great position, but I think also, honestly, that it was just, it was an IMAX 3D screening. There's a lot of projection to get in order. I think there was just something messed up about it. But like Avatar, it uses depth of screen a lot with kind of floating particles, because there's a lot of underwater scenes, right? These creatures aren't always underwater, but there's a great underwater fight at the end. Or when they're in the air, there's sort of smoke or floating dust particles. So there is a definite sense of depth to the screen that's really neat. And there are a lot of action sequences in this movie, maybe a few too many for me. Like I said, I would have rather had some more trippy neural drifting or other stuff, or world building sort of. But, if you are
Though
9 years old
bored.
And you like... No, you don't get bored. They're really nicely done. The monsters are cool. And if you are a kid who likes to watch monsters beat up on robots, and this is basically a dream movie. But I wanted to hear what you thought of how the action sequence looked. I mean, just because there have been so many criticisms of the summer action movie sequence that just uses a lot of quick cuts and smash zooms and just essentially tries to distract the audience's attention from the fact that the action makes no sense.
Yeah, this movie also tries to sort of make it feel like there's always a real camera there, even when basically you're just seeing a bunch of stuff that was created on a computer. And I thought that it does it pretty well. Those smash zooms in Man of Steel and Star Trek Into Darkness did bother me because they're a really showy way to create the idea of a camera being there. But this movie is pretty smart about it. You mentioned sort of particles and depth of field, and some of those particles do hit the camera, and there was maybe a little too much of that for me. But mostly I thought it was effective in making things feel more real. And another nice touch example of that is I read that they, for this movie, wanted to make sure that all of the lighting was motivated by something that was going on in the scene. So, if you're making a Pixar movie, you can just sort of brighten up this character without actually making sure that there's a lamp in the room shining on them. But for this movie, they didn't want to do that. And I think that's one more reason. I suspect that's one more reason that they use that sort of bioluminescent blood, because it's just one extra light source, even if the creature and the robot are fighting out in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the ocean at night.
Forrest, let me stop you for just a minute there, because it's time for a word from our sponsor. The Slate Spoiler Special is delighted to be sponsored by Shutterstock.com. With over 700,000 high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use the offer code SPOILER7. At Shutterstock.com, you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project, whether it's a website, an advertisement, multimedia presentation, or any kind of film project. They have clips in a variety of digital formats, and most come in HD. They source their video clips from around the world and put them at your fingertips, and they add 10,000 new clips a week, so every time you visit, you'll find something new. You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account, no credit card needed. Just start an account, begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like, and save video selections you find to your clip box. Once you decide to purchase, use the offer code SPOILER7, and new accounts will receive 30% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 30% off new accounts, use the offer code SPOILER7. We thank Shutterstock for their support. All right, Forrest, back to Pacific Rim. This is a pretty long movie, but in our roundabout way, I think we've kind of covered most of what we want to cover. Mm-hmm. We should talk a little bit about the ending, maybe, and also the question of whether the ending is setting up, you know, any more Pacific right. Rims. How does it all come
so
to
their,
a head?
So their final plan to cancel the apocalypse, as Idris Elba says in all of the ads.
I love his
The marketing for this movie is not very good, I think, because it's hard to convey all of the elaborate concepts in the world of the movie, which are such a big part of why it's fun.
Yeah, the stuff that's interesting about it is all the stuff that wouldn't play well in a trailer, really.
Yeah.
The neural drift scenes, that would look completely incomprehensible.
Yeah, you can't get that across in 30 seconds. So their final plan is that they need to go down to the breach and into the bridge, which is the thing sort of in the middle of the portal, and then nuke it so that the creatures can never get over again. And they haven't been able to figure out how to do that, because every time they send a bomb down, it can't get in the door. But by drifting with the Kaiju, they figure out that the door basically only unlocks if you, like, show your genetic signature.
Wow, you followed this
DNA.
So much better than I did, Forrest. I would not have been
crucial.
Able to.
Yeah.
I would not have been able to cite any of those details. I just knew they wanted to nuke the breach, and my question was, why didn't they just do it before? Okay, but now
yeah,
I'm getting.
Yeah, so it's explained in the movie, and so. So they discover that they need a genetic signature. So in the middle of this big final battle with two giant robots and this time three Kaiju, including a class 5, because they're classified like hurricanes and sometimes like predicted like earthquakes. It was really fun how they played with all of those different parallels. They realize they have to kill one of those creatures and sort of use it to swipe the key card in the door, the mm-hmm. genetic key card in the door, and go into the breach. But, you know, what happens is that Idris Elba's character plus the hotshot sort of
the Aussie guy,
Iceman, arrogant type character in terms of Top Gun. Some of this stuff reminded me of Top Gun.
He is an Iceman. You're right.
Yeah. They realize they're not going to be able to do it. So those guys blow themselves up to create a
diversion. Yes, Idris Elba and the Aussie sacrifice themselves.
The creatures. And then they go in and self-destruct their old-school nuclear-powered robot to destroy the bridge for now.
Right. But then Rinko Kikuchi and Charlie Hunnam's characters are shot up back through the sea in pods, and they make it at the end. And we see them sort of snuggling on their pod. In the
it's
very,
a very like James
shot.
Bond kind of ending, right? I couldn't help but think of that. There are like 5 different James Bond movies that end up with like the hero and his girl, although, you know, the woman in this movie is much more than just a Bond girl, thankfully, you know, surfacing and laying on a raft, and then they're, like, about to get it on is sort of the feeling that I got at the end of this movie.
Right, right. And they're radioing to them, guys, are you there? And they're just sort of gazing into each other's eyes.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, we forgot to mention Clifton Collins Jr., who I thought was really good in
so
this
I don't
very
know him
thankless
as well.
Role. He was basically the kind of air traffic controller, right? Mm-hmm. He was some kind of on-the-ground engineer who basically narrates to us what's going on while sitting behind all kinds of crazy three-dimensional computer screens. Clifton Collins Jr. is just this really, really cool actor who is always popping up in small character roles and things and never seems to get like a lead role. He's like the Kevin Corrigan kind of figure.
Yeah,
I recognized
him, but
around
couldn't
the edges.
Place him. Yeah.
I'm trying to think of some things he's been in recently. He was in Sunshine Cleaning and he was great in that. Okay. But yeah, he's always the extra guy. And he was sort of steampunk in this too. He was always walking around mm-hmm. in like tweed pants and a bow tie and he was awesome. All right, so is there anything else we want to say to wrap up? We're recommending this.
Definitely,
overall, right?
Very highly. We're in the drift on this one.
I don't
one.
Know if I'm as high as you. I mean, there was really a lot of kablammo monster fighting, and it was a little bit too long. I could have taken 20 minutes out of this movie happily or added 20 minutes about other stuff.
The 12-year-old in me definitely would have enjoyed this movie even more than I did now, but that 12-year-old part of me still exists and totally came out watching.
Yeah, no. And
my jaw dropped at least a couple times in a totally involuntary way where I only realized it after the fact.
Right.
And that hasn't happened probably since Inception or Avatar.
And the fact that a movie about this, about something that we feel like we've seen a lot of, which is big creatures battling it out in cities during the apocalypse, the fact that it could be made to feel this fresh is pretty impressive. I commend Del Toro on that.
Yeah, I mean, that's maybe one thing we can talk about is how it manages to bring together all of these different somewhat familiar elements, but to put them together into this pastiche. So, you know, the name of the monsters is Kaiju, which comes from, that's the name of the Japanese monster movie genre.
I think it's Kaiju. Like, just Kaiju?
Right? Okay. That's the name of the Japanese monster movie genre. In fact, the movie is dedicated to Ishiro Honda, who directed the first Godzilla movie and several others, and Ray Harryhausen, who, you know, sadly just died back in May. So it has those elements. It has the giant the Jaegers, which come from primarily, I think, from these mecha anime movies. There's the sort of Top Gun element. What else is in there? There's a lot of video game kind of elements, I think, in terms of how they control the creatures. Feels very much like a video game to me.
I mean, I saw some Blade Runner in there, but I guess you could say that Blade Runner has influenced the design of practically every science fiction movie since it was made. But the way Hong Kong looks, with the, you know, kind of layering of different cultural kind of signifiers, and the way that the bones of the kaiju are used as these like architectural elements in the city.
Yeah.
There's like a I guess a cult that worships the kaiju, and they build their chapel out of the rib cage, and that stuff was all just wildly imaginative and cool.
Yeah, and they have those tiny sort of skin parasites, or at least they're tiny compared to the kaiju, but they're actually, you know, the size of Dobermans or something.
Yeah, these giant ticks.
It's a funny skill.
There's
joke
a lot
too.
Of that kind of stuff. And again, if you liked Hellboy and the scene in Hellboy where they go under the bridge and there's all these kind of bizarre creatures from, you know, of different body types, that stuff is all over the place here too.
It's funny. I read that the way that they chose all of the monsters is that they basically, so Del Toro brought a bunch of these sort of top creature designers together in his creature lab, and then they set up what they described as a monster American Idol, where I guess it was like some sort of like a tournament where they determined which one was basically a combination of the scariest and the most sort of original. They didn't want each monster to look like, you know, they didn't want one to be a homage to Godzilla and another to just look like a T-Rex or anything like that.
I hope they filmed all that and that there'll be a feature on the DVD.
That would be great. I want to see the bracket.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for coming in to spoil Pacific Rim with me. Let's do another scene.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Our producer is Chris Wade. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Andy Bowers. For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.